Good morning, everybody, and welcome to IT1 Module 8. Hope you've had a good week, as we have here. Okay, right, let's start off first with our usual. We'll do a quick quiz on Module 7. But just before we do, today we're going to be talking about some interesting gear, about networks. So hopefully it'll be a nice, interesting lesson for you today. Okay, so last week we were talking about all sorts of printers and scanners. I've got some questions on those for you. So if you've got your chat windows open, we'll get going. All right, question one. Which technology is used by dot matrix printers? Is it A, digital drop, B, electrostatic spray, C, electrophotographic, D, ink melting, or E, impact?
Oh dear.
Yes. No. It's not D. Supriti, you got it right. You said E. And it was E. It was impact. Okay. So, yeah. That's dot matrix. The dot gives it away. Dot. Okay. Impact. Did sound like a Morse code, do I?
No, sort of a bit demented, but that's all right.
A demented Morse code. Did it. Yeah, impact. Okay. Question two. Which phase of the laser printing process includes applying the toner to the latent image? Is it A, cleaning, B, conditioning, C, developing, D, fusing, or E, transferring? No, they haven't.
You're all wrong.
Oh, someone's right.
Yeah, we have one right answer.
Yep. So whoever said C, and I'm not sure who that was.
It was Akhilesh,
yes. Okay, well done, Akhilesh.
Now, the trick there is that you are developing the image, so you're taking the latent image and you're applying the toner to it, therefore the image is developing. Geraldine's just moving hers, I think.
I was, sorry, yes. Okay, question three. What are the advantages of impact printers? Now, this is one where they want a choose three. I'm going to just say yes, no's, all right? There's too many to remember otherwise. Okay. Is this an advantage of an impact printer? Is this a disadvantage of an impact printer? Yes or no? Expensive consumables?
No.
And in actual fact, it's a no. It's not a disadvantage.
Hang on, isn't this question sort of a double negative?
Yeah, it looks like it to me. Yeah. Let me try and reword it somehow, because I would have said that too.
Okay, does it want disadvantage or advantages?
Disadvantages of impact printers. Okay. All right, the next one, is this a yes or no? We'll continue on as we are and see how we go. High power consumption. Getting a mixture of answers, so it is a no.
Yeah, it's
not a disadvantage.
It's laser that's high power consumption, people.
Impact. Okay. Okay. There's a little fight going on here, folks. Children are at play.
Okay. And on the green corner. No, just kidding. Okay, next question. Next option.
Okay, is this a disadvantage of an impact printer? Limited colour capability.
Well done.
Yay, you got it. That's good. Yeah, good. Noisy printing. Good one. That's right. Slow printing.
Nice.
Well done. You got them all. That's good.
Yeah, they measure the print speed in pages per millennium.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, next question. Which type of printer melts ink and sprays it through a nozzle onto a drum to transfer an image onto the paper? Is it A, solid ink, B, impact, C, inkjet? Hang on, I haven't finished yet. And I haven't got to the correct answer yet.
Now, just one thing, people. If you're going to type the answer in, just don't press the return key until she's finished talking. Because you're just giving everybody else the answer, or the wrong one.
So for those who jumped in and got the right answer wrong, nah. Okay, so, all right, the options are again, A, fusion ink, B, impact, C, inkjet, D, laser, E, solid ink. Okay, now you can answer.
And you're all wrong.
Oh, my God. No, somebody's right.
Sabad is right. Well done.
Sabad. Yes, Sabad, you were correct. The only one correct. That was solid ink. I think we should do that module again.
Now, the trick here, solid ink. It melts the ink and sprays it through a nozzle. So the ink has to be solid for it to melt it. Because that's the only way you can get from a solid to a liquid is to melt. So that's the giveaway for that question. Solid ink melts the ink and sprays it through a nozzle. It was E.
So what is laser? Hang on, what was that question? So what is laser ink? Oh, we said laser. Yeah. Ah. Yes, no, it melts the ink and sprays it through a nozzle. Okay, so Subod, you get a cyber lollipop. Okay, next question. Which type of printing process uses solid sheets of ink that change directly to gas when the print head heats the ink? Is it A, dye sublimation, B, impact, C, inkjet, D, laser, E, solid ink, or F, thermal? Go now.
F.
Oh, we've got an interesting lot of answers. So for those that said A, you are correct. Okay, so that was dye sublimation, that one.
Can I just gently suggest that everybody take a listen to this module again between now and, say,
final exam,
and we're going to run this quiz again.
Yeah, I think so, because this one is a really important one, because you will definitely get questions on it.
And it's a pain, and it's boring, and it's tedious, and it's awful, and who cares about printers because we're blind, but it's in your exam. Sorry.
Yeah. So you have to pass it, or you have to know it. Okay. Next. Yes, Saprita. Good one, Saprita. Yes, you were correct.
My brain just went, she was typing on that quiz tonight, Saprita. And I thought, no, that was just a bit sad. But yes, you are correct. You get two cyber lollipops.
And Subad got it too. You get another one.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Enjoy them, won't you? Okay, now next question. Yeah, we will do this quiz again because it really is important to know all these, because you're definitely going to get questions on it. Okay, which peripheral is used to convert paper documents into electronic files? Is it A, a digital reader, B, a printer, C, a projector, or D, a scanner? Oh, they're a good one. At least you know about scanners. That's good. Yeah, it was D, a scanner. Actually, that's the advantage of running these quick quizzes, because it really does make you see where you need to review. And, yeah. Okay.
I'm just petrified if I did them in Discovery, you'd all just go completely silent.
Silence ain't golden.
Oh, announcement. Yes. We're running ITE on Thursday next week because Easter will get in the way. So you could either do it from home if you can't come in, or, Thursday next week.
Friday's Good Friday, and we'll all be on leave. And Oh, and after that, 2 weeks is free of lectures as well. So
this would be a great time for you to catch up on those labs and worksheets that you've fallen behind on. 2 whole weeks for you to sit down, knuckle down, start studying, and submit, submit, submit. 2 whole weeks. Start now. Okay, maybe not.
Oh, no, it's final 2 weeks for us. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so you all get to catch up on your worksheets and stuff.
I must give you one of those results for breakfast every Friday. I bought Kerry in a risol today. He liked that. So. Okay. Next question. How is the speed of a laser printer measured? Is it A, dots per minute, B, pages per minute, C, pixels per second, D, pages per second, or E, pages per week? Well done, everybody. That was B, yes, pages per minute. You're awake now, are you? That's good. Okay. Yes, as I said, we will do that quiz again at some stage. We'll just throw it in and see how you're doing with it. Okay.
Good morning, Gemma. You've escaped the quiz.
Okay.
Okay, welcome, Gemma. All right, as I mentioned before, we are talking about networks today. So we'll be discussing things like local area networks, wide area networks, and wireless networks or wireless LANs. We'll be talking about all the different topologies and the protocols and the models that we use. So we're going to be doing all sorts of fun things like talking about the OSI, TCP, IP. And if you don't know what we're talking about, then we'll be explaining that as we go along. One of Kerry's specialties, for those that do CCNA, is talking about networks. And I should sit back. Actually, oh! That's my mobile phone, sorry folks. Kerry, just wondering if you'd like to do, just to make everybody really happy on a nice Friday morning, is to do a quick abbreviated excerpt before we start on the full thing of networking.
Oh, I think we can do that. All right, and here we go. People have always wanted to connect their computers together, so they use networks. There are various types of networks, including Ethernet, wireless, token ring, and various other connectivity options, such as microwave. People have the need to be connected, and they wish to share information. The local area network usually consists of Ethernet cards, either using 10Base2, 10Base5, or 10Base-T. 10Base-T is twisted pair, and has 10 megabits per second. There are also 100Base-T and 1000Base-T options for twisted pair. There is also the ability to use wireless networking, which is 802.11a, b, g, or n. You can use any of these wireless networks to connect your machine together. However, you have to be aware of security, authentication, encryption, and the safety of your wireless network. There are 2 models in existence. There is the TCP/IP model, which came first in the early 70s, and the OSI reference model. The TCP/IP model has four layers. The bottom layer being the network access layer. The next layer up from that is the network layer. The network layer up from that is the transport layer, and then above that, finally, the application layer. Then there is also the Open Systems Interconnect model, which has been ratified by the ISO in the early 80s. It has 7 models. The physical layer, the data link layer, the network layer, the transport layer, the session layer, the presentation layer, and the application layer. Please do not throw sausage pizza away. This layer is used to, these two models are used to compare protocols so that you can compare the TCP/IP to the OSI reference model and compare the OSI reference model to other network protocols so that you can compare the various states of the protocols. I think that'll do. Now we'll go into the regular lecture.
God, wonderful.
Wow, what was in that breakfast you gave him?
I thought you might enjoy that, folks. He's pretty good at that. Oh, dear. Are we all awake now?
In fact, Discovery 1, next time we run it, will be done over 2 hours.
Sorry, Suprita, you were about to say something. I think it was Suprita.
Oh, dear. Wake and charged too, you know, charged up with spirits.
He's pretty good at that, isn't he? All right, now we'll get serious. Oh, dear. All right. We do that at least once a year. I can't even keep up with that. Okay. All right. So the principles of networking. Networks where you have a system that's formed by a series of links. For example, if you're going to a website, you're linking into pages. So we talk about those as social networking. So if we think about a set of related ideas, we call it a conceptual network. So you've got, for example, if you've got a connection and you've got all of your friends on, you'd call that a personal network.
Social networking? Can you say MySpace? Facebook? Twitter?
Yes.
MSN Messenger? There's all sorts of social networking sites. Bebo is another one. LinkedIn. Now, just very briefly, and I'm only going to take 20 seconds or so to do this, and I promise I won't speak as fast as I was earlier. I would strongly recommend students get onto www.linkedin.com. It's a really good site where you can put up your work qualifications and your resumes and things, and people actually do find employees by looking on these sites such as LinkedIn, and you put in as much or as little information as you want, and I'm sure a lot of you have got very good jobs, but you might actually be looking for other jobs in future, and if you actually update your LinkedIn profile, you can actually get that sort of information. And for those of you who I know and who've submitted their labs, hint hint, you can actually find me on LinkedIn, and I'll write something nice about you to add to your profile so that people can see that I have actually worked with you, and that we vouch for you to a certain degree. So social networking site well worth a look, linkedin.com. End of advertisement.
Yeah, it is a good one actually. Okay, so when you think about it, we use all types of networks every day. Can you think of some of the types of networks that we might use?
Phone.
Yep, telephone system. Any others, folks?
Email.
Yeah.
The wireless.
As in like the regular wireless, as in it's 25 past 7, keep that smile on the dial wireless.
Yes. How about the yeah, that's a... Well, face-to-face is also a network, isn't it? Yep. Your computer networks within a corporation, also things like the... how about your the mail? You know, the mail comes every day, the mail delivery.
The postal network.
Postal network. That's the word I was looking for.
There you go. I'm doing word fill-in duty today.
Okay, so... Yeah, we're using them every day of our lives when we didn't even know. Okay, so you can also have your computers linked into a network, and most of us probably have, or, you know, certainly have used a computer network. You can have a simple network where you've just got two computers connected. They might be by cable, or it might be wireless, and it allows that flow of information between those two computers. Alternatively, you can have, you know, 10, 20, 100, 300 loads of computers all connected. Yeah, thousands, yeah.
Oh, you've been to my house.
I have. And you can also have things like your printers and that sort of networked as well. So we've probably all used a printer that's been connected to a network. Thereby, you're saving a bit of resources because you don't all need a printer sitting on your desk, and you can just network and use the same printer.
Now, interestingly enough, when we used to run these networking courses back in 1995, because I used to teach TAFE, we used to ask people who has more than one computer, and about one person would put their hand up, one or two people. And now if you ask who has more than one computer, there are a lot of people who do have more than one computer or who certainly use more than one computer. The other question that we started getting a different answer to was when I asked in 1995 who had ever heard of Linux, there was one person in my class. When I asked the same question in 1999, every hand went up. So it's interesting because I could smell the BO. I was just asked how I knew whether every hand went up.
Oh, dear. No more whistles for you, Kevin.
Okay.
Okay, so all of your data, your voice, things like video, you can have them all being used as part of a network. Okay, so when we're talking about a computer data network, it's basically a collection of hosts, and the host is any device basically that sends and receives information that's actually on a network. You can have your peripherals connected to the hosts, so you can have, for example, you know, your printer is connected to something like a network device, something like a hub or a switch or a router that's actually acting as a host.
Now, just for local students, what you've got here is sockets in the wall, which run back through to a patch panel, which is about two rooms down the corridor. And in that patch panel, there's a whole lot of where all the cables all come together, and then they run together into the gigabit switches. And then for Trevor and Jenny, obviously, they plug into a gigabit switch, an 8-port gigabit switch that's sitting on the desk here, which then hooks into the main infrastructure. And I think Peter's computer plugs into the switch over near where Geraldine is. So that's sort of how the cabling and that sort of works.
So switches can certainly be useful to expand the number of computers that you're connecting up. Has everybody seen a switch?
A networking switch?
Good. Okay.
We'll bring a switch out to show the local students, and the remote students will just have to imagine really, really hard. Hopefully you guys can see a switch. Ask your IT people if they can show you a network switch if you haven't seen one. A lot of home routers have an inbuilt switch on them, so if you've got a 4-port home router, that does actually have a switch in it, and those 4 ports are connected to the switch.
Mm. And you can have lots of, as I mentioned before, lots of different types of devices that you can connect to your network. So you can have your desktop computer, which all of us have got. You can also connect up your laptop computer to your network. And as I mentioned before, things like printers, scanners, all those types of things. But lots these days too, you can connect in your smartphone. I use my phone on my home network from time to time, which is very handy. So there's lots of things you can do. And you can also, as I briefly mentioned, share your resources. I mentioned printing. You can also share a scanner on a network. The other thing you can do is things like sharing your removable storage devices, things like your external hard drives. And the other thing that you can do too is share your applications. You can share, you know, software. You can share your databases, those types of things. So very handy thing is to have a network set up.
Now, just a warning to people, however, if you are running XP Home and you only have simple file sharing enabled, be very careful what you share read-write on your network, because anybody who connects into your network will have read-write access to any read-write shares. So I would be encouraging most people who are running Windows XP Home to share resources read-only to stop other people from messing with their files.
Mm, good point.
Or don't share anything at all. Well, be aware of what you share. I mean, if you're going to share a printer, that's okay because it's a shared resource. But if you're actually going to share subfolders and stuff,
I don't think so.
I think you're right. I think it's free for all. Yeah, I think
it's only read.
It's shared or not shared.
You just can only read. I don't believe you can set a write permission at all in the first place.
Oh, you can set a write permission. I've done it. Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can actually set a write permission. That's right.
It's shared or not shared. I'm not sure if it's read or write.
That's okay. It just so happens we've got two people with EAPs running XP Home here, so I'll commandeer one of them after lecture and find out once and for all whether you can set a read-write-share or not. I think if you give other people access to your files, that does implicitly grant them write permission. That was my understanding.
That's what I thought.
I thought it implicitly didn't, but... Oh,
well, I'm going to go and look up Microsoft later and find out, because it will actually tell you on Microsoft. There's actually an article that says the difference between simple file sharing and stuff. And whilst Microsoft might have it wrong too, we'd hope that they'd have a better idea than we do. So we'll go look that up later and find out. But yeah, I think if you give access to your files, it actually gives them write permission. And that's why I didn't like simple file sharing. The shared documents folder is an anomaly. It's a special one that's read-only. But if you actually share out other folders and give people access to the files, I think anybody or the group, everyone, gets write permission, which is a bit disturbing.
Hmm. Well, perhaps we can put some of that up on the discuss a bit later too, and just sort of clarify that for everyone after lecture. Okay, network devices actually link together using a number of different types of connections. You can use cabling, obviously, copper cabling. Anyone think of some other ways that you can actually link up network devices, I should say?
Wireless.
Yep, wireless. I heard someone say fibre optic cabling.
Yeah. You can hook it in via USB over on a computer, and then you can share it.
Yeah, you can. And in fact, you can actually link computers together via the USB ports if you're feeling that masochistic. It's a bit slow and not very efficient. There is another way you can actually link computers together, if anybody can think of it. It starts with F, and it's not fibre. Yeah, Firewire, which is now called iLink, because Firewire is trademarked by Apple, and Apple's lawyers are nasty.
No, I thought that was the new Apple name for it, because they want everything starting with I.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, I think you are right, actually. iLink is the new Apple name for it, so you can have I die, I feel tired, I life, iLink, I won't.
I will.
There is actually a company called I Will, and they make motherboards and computer peripherals.
Okay.
Surprised Apple hasn't sued them.
I think they're they probably make some components for Apple though.
Okay, so the different types of cabling or ways of methods of networking different devices together, we've identified them. So if we just talk briefly about them, like copper cabling, with that you use electrical signals and they transmit data along the cable to the devices. With regards to fibre optics, it uses glass or plastic wire, also referred to as fibre, and it carries information as a light pulse. It's very, very fast and efficient. Wireless uses radio signals, also uses laser or infrared, and also can use satellite transmissions. So just to give you a bit of a brief overview of those.
Well, here we've got, I've just been asked what we've got here. We've got gigabit copper. I think we have fibre between the floors to hook the switchblades together, and we have wireless. We've got an N router here, and there are some G routers upstairs. I think they've got some cheap D-Links off the sale or something, so there's white boot of wireless upstairs. So yeah, that's what we've got here. And anybody who listened to Wednesday's lecture would have heard more about wireless than they thought possible, so if you are not studying ITE1, I would recommend, so if you are not studying Discovery, I would recommend that you have a listen to Discovery 1 Lecture 7, and it will go all about wireless networking. Or was it Lecture 8? Can't remember which one it was. It's the one that just went up the other day.
Oh, that's a good idea, because that'll just reinforce what we're talking about today. Good point. Okay, so as I mentioned briefly before, some of the benefits of networking your computers. One would be that you've got lower costs involved, because if you, say, only need one printer as opposed to 50 printers, obviously you're saving on costs. A lot of organisations have too many people using one printer though, and you end up with these huge queues at the printer whenever you want to print something, which is a bit of a pain.
Both on and off the server.
Yes, yeah. So, but they do lower your overall costs, and with the allowing of your resources, the sharing of them, you know, you've got less opportunities for duplication or corruption of data as well.
Well, one of the interesting points, I was actually going to make two points. One is, we had a person who believed that if you had a printer queue and the printer queue got jammed, you just put a really big job in the top of it. It was a bit like unblocking a toilet, and then that would cause the printer queue to unblock itself. We had to explain to him that no, print queues and toilets were completely different things, and you could not apply the same logic. And also, it's not actually the printers on everybody's desk that it is actually the problem as such. I mean, mean, it is a bit of a maintenance nightmare, and it is a bit of a pain, especially when the secretary sticks a bubble gin on her desk because she absolutely has to have one, or he absolutely has to have one. Let's be in 2009 here. It's actually the problem of the cost of the ink tanks for every printer on every desk. And when you're looking at $50 a throw per for some ink tanks, that's when the budget gets blown out by you buying a $70 printer and then some set of $50 ink tanks, and that's when people tend to be cranky and you put in a shared printer and there's only one printer to maintain, and then there's you know, everybody can use that shared resource. And in fact, I saw a funny cartoon which is quite explainable. There was a photo of an office staff, and it had, you know, this is John from management, and this is Bill from accounting, and this is Janet from the secretaries, and this is, you know, Jill from sales, and there's our printer technician. As if to say the printer technician was in the office so much that he actually showed up in the office photo.
Interesting. Okay, so as mentioned...
I was going to say you get that printer to share with everyone, and then they end up replacing the ink every couple of days because there's so many people printing to the one printer.
Oh, I've seen that too. You just share out the bubble jet. I've got a bubble jet on my desk, so how about we just share out my bubble jet? Well, guess what, people? The average ink tank in a bubble jet is good for 500 pages at 3% coverage, not for printing the pictures of your family pet, and you really go through the ink tanks once you start printing photos on a bubble jet.
Yeah, exactly. So we've worked out that, you know, sharing your peripherals is one of the advantages of networking. Some of the other advantages, you've got things like email. We've got big rats in the roof. Somebody's walking in the ceiling above us. Okay, so you've got, and we call things like email, you know, chat, voice, video, instant messaging, all those things is online collaboration tools. And so there's an increased potential for those online collaboration tools.
And interestingly enough, does anybody remember the world before Skype? I mean, we had Messenger and ICQ and Yahoo Messenger and Yahoo and all those sorts of things. They've been around for quite a while. But where would this course be without Skype? Just pause for thought. And as far as I recollect, I think Skype hit the world in 2003. It was sort of August 2003, because I remember we weren't married yet and Gemma set her name to Gemma Hoth, which was all a bit out there. Yeah, that was when we first got into Skype. And the technology that allows Skype to work is actually taken from the Kazaa file sharing network. The peer-to-peer file sharing network that, of course, nobody on this chat would know anything about. I certainly don't. That's right.
You know, it doesn't... no, I'm showing my age here. it doesn't seem that long ago when we didn't have mobile phones and we didn't have all these computers and, yeah.
And an article that Grace pointed us to the other day on Twitter, and if you don't know what Twitter is, you can find out about it. Is an article that says that if we get a significantly bigger sun flare from the plasma storm on the sun, it will actually disrupt all of the world's electrical grids and induce fatal charges into the power grids, which will blow up everything electrical we have. So there you go, we just all now feel a little bit more secure. Don't panic about those sunspots too much. But it would certainly be very unpleasant if it wiped out huge sections of the huge sections of the electrical grids, because the wire networks are not designed to have short high voltage bursts of current induced into them by a plasma storm.
And everybody remember Y2K. Yes, the big kerfuffle that went on about that in 2000. Yeah. Okay, we digress, but yeah. All right, now I mentioned too that by having a network, you're avoiding file duplication, also potential for corruptions. So if you think about that statement, we think you've got a server managing a network resources, so all of the data is being stored on the server, and then it gets shared with those who are using the network.
And it should also get backed up.
Yes.
I was just pointing that out.
So any of the sensitive data that your organisation is using is protected and only shared with those users who've got permission to access the data. So you can make different levels of access permission for the users on your network.
Now, handiest hint you're ever going to hear, if you ever become a network administrator, don't give people permissions and then take them away. Don't give them permissions to start with and hand the permissions out on an as-needs basis. That way people get a lot less cranky because you just lock them out by default and then only let them into the things that they need to know. So it's the need-to-know policy and you unlock things on an as-needs basis. So that will save you a lot of grief, or it'll give you a different sort of grief that's easier to manage with.
Yep. Another point that's good about networking is that you've got lower costs of licensing because you're not having to license different programs for each and every computer because you're sharing that software within the organisation. Well, you've got a site license, haven't you, generally?
Well, and what I was actually going to explain is that with licensing, there's two ways of licensing, especially with Microsoft software. One is per seat, which is basically how many computers you've got accessing the software, how many computers you've got. In other words, how many chairs you've got in front of computers. And then the other way to license it is a CAL license, or a client access license, and then you actually license it for how many simultaneous users will be accessing the software at once. And interestingly enough, if you buy a copy of Windows Server, you actually have to buy it. This is assuming that you're being legal, which of course you are. You actually have to buy the number of client access licenses as people you will have simultaneously accessing the server at any one time. So if you've only got five people, you only need a 5-cal license. If you've got 20 people, you need a 20-cal license. And one of the other problems that we have is if you actually go and buy the Microsoft Small Business Server, which is the really cheapy one, but does actually give you 100 client access licenses for about $5,000, if your business grows beyond 100 people, you can't actually migrate it to a full-fledged server without corrupting your entire Active Directory infrastructure. So if you think your company's ever going to get bigger than 100, don't buy a Small Business Server. Client access licenses is how many concurrent clients are going to access it, and per seat is actually how many actual people you've got that need a copy of such and such a piece of software. And the only reason I bring that up is because it's very important that you as an IT administrator are aware of the licensing requirements, restrictions, hoops, bends, twists and turns, so that you don't get yourself stung by licensing, because it is a nasty legal black hole.
Thanks, Kerry. The other advantages too is that you've got a centralised administration, so you've got an administrator who's looking after the network, assigning permissions, and they're doing their backups daily, we hope, and probably even more regularly than that. Okay, there's a conservation of resources as well, so networking is the way to go for most businesses, and as it's becoming more and more common in homes as well. Okay, data networks allow us, communication, and there's a number of different types of aspects of what types of characteristics that they have. So I guess we refer to them in ways of, when we're talking about network, the area of the network, the data that you're storing on it, how your resources are being managed, how it's organised, devices used, and that type of thing. So, okay, so there's a number of different types of networks, as I mentioned before. We have LANs. Anyone tell me what LAN stands for? I'm sure you all can.
Local Area Network.
That's correct, thank you.
Saprita gets another lollipop.
Oh, we're getting lots of lollipops going out. That's good. Yeah. So
and
a LAN.
So does Chantel
is
and Grace.
Thank you.
Much appreciated.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Okay. So when we're talking about a local area network, as it sounds in the name local, it refers to a group of interconnected devices that's under the same administrative control. That's the key to that. The same administrative control. So oftentimes they were thought of as being very small, but now LANs can be larger networks as well. So there are interconnected local network, and you can have them as a small one connecting, say, two computers, or you can have them with like many hundreds of devices. And you can have them in a number of locations as well. And the important thing, I think, there is to remember that all of the local networks within a local area network are under one administrative control group. And that control group, you know, covers things like your security, access policies, and that type of thing. All right, so what about a WAN, a W-A-N? Can anyone tell me what that stands for?
Well, it's pronounced WAN.
Wide Area Network.
Yes.
A Wide Area Network, that's right. So they basically are a network that connects LANs in a geographically separated location. And the what would be an example of that we all use every day of a WAN?
Banking?
Oh. Yeah, it's the internet.
No. No, the internet is actually a network of networks.
The connection to your ISP.
Yeah, the connection to your ISP is certainly a WAN. Yeah, we'll go with the connection to the ISP. The ISP, is, the internet is actually a network of networks, so therefore it's I suppose you could call it the worldwide WAN.
Yeah, the worldwide WAN.
And then there are also networks in the middle called MAN. And they're metropolitan area networks which are set up in cities and stuff. And there are some cities over in the States who've completely failed to get their metropolitan free wireless area networks up and running to any degree of success because they put all this infrastructure in and then couldn't figure out who was actually paying for it. So, yeah, still work in progress there.
So the internet is basically a large WAN and it's composed of millions of interconnected LANs or local area networks.
Wouldn't an organisation like banks and government departments and all sorts of things like that, wouldn't they have WANs?
Yes, and in fact, when we had the association split in half, there was actually a WAN link between Wellington Street and Vic Park. It didn't work very well, but it was there.
Okay, so in your traditional local area network, you've got devices connected using copper cabling, but sometimes you might find that installing copper is not practicable, and so you would use wireless, obviously, to transmit your data. And we refer to those networks as wireless local area networks, or WLANs. Okay. With wireless or WLANs, you can also share resources. It's all much the same as what it is, unless you've got brick walls in the way. and I say that because my home's like that, wireless is good fun there.
Didn't you actually get that ultra whopping and
I did get it. Yes, it's fine, yeah. But yeah, the principle, the original reasons for having to use that have been eradicated, but the reason, original reason's still there, the brick walls. Yeah, okay. That's the thing with wireless. Your coverage can be interfered with by many different factors, including brick walls or distance. The distance is not always, useful for running a wireless network.
We actually had a rather large friend who will remain unnamed, who whenever she stood in front of our access point, would seriously lose our signal.
Really? Oh, dear. Well, that's a worry. Okay, so there's a number of different types of networks. Another one is a peer-to-peer network. Anyone want to have a go at explaining what a peer-to-peer network is?
Go on, give it a go. Yeah, all right, go ahead, Grace.
A peer-to-peer network is computers that are connected together, and instead of a server where you have a central access point, each computer is both a client and a server, so everybody can share resources. It's not just one computer doling out all the resources, it's everybody.
Oh, you've read Chapter 7 of CCNA. Well done. That is a peer-to-peer network. Got it in one.
Well done.
Anybody tell me what one of the problems with peer-to-peer networks is? Okay. Come on, somebody else. Anybody else? Anybody tell me a problem with peer-to-peer networks? Grace has already aced the floor with... That's Grace without the G and the R. Anyway, she's obviously... They're less secure, yes. No centralised management. And possibly no centralised backup. Dun-dun-dun. And that's not very cool sometimes.
They also work best when you've got less than about 10 computers or even less. Okay, so, and that actually comes up in your exam somewhere, I seem to recall.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Somebody like to explain a client-server network?
It's okay, guys, if you explain it and get it wrong, we promise we won't laugh and point. Anybody who wants to give client-server a go, we'd love to get some class interaction there.
Would that be the type of setup you'd have in a company or a small business or...?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. A bit more. What else do you think they have? I'll give you a clue. The actual, what you're trying to describe might give you a couple of the words you might need.
You actually have one central server, don't you? And then...
That's right.
Sorry, everyone connects to the server and communicates basically through the server to each other.
Yes, and clients are the things that connect to the server.
Right, so where you've got a client actually requesting information from the server, and then that server is responding to that request for information to the client computer that's there. Okay, so, and as I think it was Jenny mentioned, they're often used in businesses and in corporate environments. Also, with that type of client-server model, you've usually got the server being maintained by the network administrator, and that network administrator does all the things like your data backups, and they look after security and organise permissions, as we mentioned before. Okay, so the other thing you're going to need to do as a network administrator is troubleshoot when things go wrong. So a number of things that you need to take into account and a number of things that you need to do is to, as I said before, look at things like security, be very aware of that, and so those are things that you will be doing as a network administrator. Okay.
Just an announcement, everybody. The door's been left open, so watch your dogs because the air conditioning's broken. They're fixing it now.
Okay. I'm just getting my doggy back, folks. Okay. All right. Now, some of the different types of things we also need to know about networks, basic networking concepts, are things like some of the terminology that's being used, and we're going to talk about the different types of terminology. Alright, I'm going to throw this back to you guys. Bandwidth. Can someone explain to me what bandwidth defines? Yes, Grace.
It's the amount of upload and download that you're going to be able to do over your network.
Yes. Because there's actually two types of bandwidth. There's analog bandwidth and digital.
The theoretical maximum.
Well, I was about to say there's two types of bandwidth. There's analog bandwidth and digital bandwidth. And analog bandwidth, as Gemma rightly points out, is the theoretical maximum carrying capacity of the communications channel. So, for example, your network may have your ADSL connection may have a theoretical, a bandwidth of 8 megabits, but your digital bandwidth is actually how much of that analog capacity carries digital data, and not all the time do the digital bandwidth and analog bandwidth match up. So you'll actually get less digital bandwidth than you'll get analog bandwidth. Although sometimes it goes the other way. So for example, with if you measure the analog bandwidth of copper cable, there is 250 megahertz of analog bandwidth per copper cable. But everybody knows there's gigabit networks. So what they actually do is they actually use all four pairs at once to send and receive data simultaneously. So you get four pairs at 250 megahertz, which then gives you the gigahertz of analog bandwidth you need to do gigabit in the digital bandwidth. Yeah, I know. Who employed him? But I just thought I'd demystify that, or perhaps mystify it up a bit more. But yeah, it is the information carrying capacity of your link, how much you can upload and download, but there is also an analog and digital component of it. Probably more information than we needed.
We'll give Kerry a cyber lollipop too, okay?
Yummy!
Question? Is the digital also faster than analog? Speed come into it?
No. Analog lines use voltages to transfer information. So, for example, in the old days, your phone lines used to be analog. The digital bandwidth refers to the number of bits per second that you can transfer. So if you've got a 1.5/256 ADSL, that's 1.5 megabits down, digital bandwidth, 256 kilobytes per second up. Whereas the analog bandwidth is usually measured in megahertz because it's actually referring to the frequencies and range of frequencies that the cable or the fibre or the channel can carry.
Okay, so as Kerry's been talking in bits per second, megabits per second, when we're talking about bandwidth, it's measured in bits per second. So it can be bits per second, BPS, or kilobits per second, KBPS, and etc. and so on, megabits
per
second.
And it's a lowercase b. A capital B is bytes.
Yes.
It's very important.
Can anyone tell me how many bits are in one byte?
Eight bits,
that's correct. Yep.
Yeah, generally speaking, a byte in 2009 is 8 bits, but Jenny is correct. It does depend on how big the bytes are. You can actually have different size bytes. I mean, if Jenny's byte's probably about 300 bits. No, just kidding. Not at all. So, yeah, we can certainly have different size bytes, but generally speaking, byte is 8 bits.
8 is the most it can be, right?
There were some weird machines that could have 16-bit bytes, but, I mean, generally speaking, the ASCII character set works on 8-bit bytes, and most systems do work on 8-bit bytes. But back in the early days, there were systems that worked on 5 and 6-bit bytes, because you didn't have high ASCII, and you needed space to transfer parity bits, which we don't talk about. But, yeah, generally speaking, the answer we do want is 8 bits in a byte. The reason we make that distinction is because if you're sending data over a serial link, you actually have one start bit, 8 data bits, and 1 stop bit, so you actually have 10 bits in the serial byte, whereas there's only 8 bits of data that actually get sent, just to make everybody a little bit more smarter. So 8 bits is the answer we want.
Okay. So your data... is being transmitted over the network, and it can use a number of modes to do that. And I can guarantee you will get questions on this in your exam. There are 3 modes. There's simplex, half duplex, or full duplex. All the CCNA people will know all about this already. So simplex we refer to as unidirectional, so it's just a one way of moving the data. So for example, if you had a simplex transmission, you'd have your signal being sent from, say, for example, a TV station, and it arrives at your home TV. So it's sort of flowing in one direction, unidirectional.
And that's a lecture from your significant other. They're usually simplex. Information flow in one direction, and that's certainly a real-world example of simplex.
Okay, half duplex is another way. Anyone want to have a go at explaining half duplex?
Is anybody still awake, apart from Grace?
I'm here.
I'm here.
Then I'll do it.
All right. You get to do half duplex.
It's when you can receive transmission both ways, but not at the same time.
Yeah, that's correct. Data communication in one direction only, with a noticeable turnaround delay. So you can turn the channel around, but it does take significant time to turn around the channel. Can anybody give me an example of a half duplex method of communication?
Radio.
Yeah, that's a good cue.
Yeah, and the other thing, and this will get a little bit of debate going, but we might quash the debate, but phone lines are also half duplex. Yes.
So does that mean then that full duplex means that you can have information going both ways at the same time?
That's correct.
Well done.
Jenny gets a cyber lollipop too. Okay, yeah, that's correct. So you've got, in full duplex, you've got your data flowing in both directions at the same time, and but you actually, the bandwidth's only measured in one directional. So when we talk about our network cables, they've got 100 megabits per second in full duplex mode and have bandwidth of 100 megabits per second.
Did you say 200 megabits full duplex and bandwidth of 100 megabits? Is that what you said?
No, I said 100 and 100.
Oh, that's interesting, because there are actually networking manuals, and quite a lot of them, that actually say that the maximum bandwidth of the switch is 200 megabits, because it can transfer 100 megabits up and 100 megabits down simultaneously. So if you get asked in the question in the test, it's 100 megabits for each, but yeah, I've seen it actually referred to 200 megabits bandwidth for full dimensional switches, full duplex switches.
Okay, and your telephone conversation would be an example of your full duplex communication. So you've got both people can talk and they can also be heard at the same time. So I guess that's a...
No, they can't. And in fact, Ian pulled me up on this when I said that. Is that what the notes say?
Yep.
Oh, well, interestingly enough, there's only two wires on a telephone, and you can only send or receive at the same time. The thing that makes it look like it's full duplex is that the turnaround delay is in milliseconds, but the actual phone lines only send or receive at the same time. They can't do both at the same time. It's just that the flip around is so quick that you can't hear it.
It's so quick, it seems like it. Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, by the notes definition of noticeable delay, then I guess telephones would be full duplex, right?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, because we're talking about whether the delay is noticeable to actually turn the communications channel around. Then, yes, you would say that the delay on a phone system isn't noticeable, although you might say that the delay on a mobile phone is noticeable by the time you put in the encoder-decoder delay from the GSM codecs.
Oh, Skype definitely is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. But the interesting thing about Skype, the reason Skype is half duplex is because when you've got people with microphones and speakers, you actually have to echo cancel out what's coming out the speakers in the microphone, otherwise you'll get feedback. So Skype has to make itself half duplex so that it can actually do echo cancellation, so that the microphones and speakers brigade won't actually feed their own sound back into the send channel. And that's why if you've got Ventrilo, you don't do very well if you've got microphone and speakers, because if you open up your microphone and there's still sound coming out your speakers, it'll get looped back onto channel, because it's very difficult to echo cancel on a full duplex setup if you don't know what the round trip delay is going to be. Oh, well, there you go.
Okay. Just having a drink when I got caught then.
Oh, sorry, do you want me to talk about something while you're drinking?
No, I've finished. That's fine. Thank you. Okay, now we're going to talk about IP addressing. And for all our CCNA people, I know you'll know all about this. But for those that haven't done CCNA, we'll talk a little bit about IP addressing. So an IP address is a number, and it's used to identify a device that's on the network.
How many bits?
32.
Oh, well done.
Thank you.
Well done. So for those all smarties who've done CCNA, well done. but we'll just, and I know you've heard this all before, but we'll go over it again anyway. Some people haven't done CCNA, so we just need to cover it. So each device that's on a network needs to have a unique IP address in order for it to communicate with each of the network devices. We talked a little bit earlier about hosts. So a host is a device which sends or receives information on the network. And network devices are devices that move the data across the network, and they do that by the way of hubs, switches and routers. So for example, on a local area network, each host and each network device needs to have an IP address within the same network, and it needs that so it's able to communications open. We need to have a unique IP address.
And what is the other thing that tells you whether machines are in the same network or not? Anyone?
Their subnet mask.
That's correct.
Okay, and we'll talk more about that as we go on too. Okay, the other thing, on a host you have a what is called a MAC address. Anyone know what MAC address stands for? MAC?
Media Access Control.
That's correct. And that MAC address is assigned to the host network interface card and is known as the physical address. Okay. Let's get physical. I know you were waiting for that, Kerry.
Yeah. how many bits long is the MAC address?
48.
Anyone else want to have a guess? I'm not saying whether she's right or wrong. No, it's 48, people. It is 48 bits for a MAC address. I promise you that it is in your CCNA final exam. There are 48, 32 is the IP address, and 48 bits is the MAC address. Very important that you get those around the right way, or you lose a mark in your final if you're doing discovery.
So your MAC address, or your physical address, is going to remain the same regardless of where the host is placed on the network. Okay? If you think about an IP address, it's similar to having like a postcode address almost. It's a mailing address. So it's known as a logical address. And it's known as that because it's logically assigned based on the host or the location of the host. So the IP address or the network address is based on the local area network and is assigned to each host by the network administrator. And it's consistent with, as we mentioned, a series of 32 binary bits, or ones and zeros in computer lingo. Okay, so the 32 bits are grouped into four bytes. Okay, so they're 8-bit bytes called octets. So the IP address is... in that way, it's actually quite hard for us to remember all a series of zeros and ones that you might have, because you might have, you know, 110011 whatever. So we actually make it into octets, and we use something called dotted decimal notation. So if you've got a host configured with an IP address, it's entered in a dotted decimal number. So you might have, instead of having 00111100,
you could have something like that.
Yeah, that's right. So it makes it easier to remember, okay? The logical 32-bit IP address is hierarchical, and it's composed of two parts. So the first part of it identifies the network, and the second part identifies the host that's on the network. So you need both the host and the network part, or the network and host part of your address and your IP
now,
address.
Here, for example, we're all on the 192.168.100 network, and my machine is host number 132, the Spark is host number 4, the web server is host number 152, and you can actually look up what your IP address is under the support tab of your network settings, and we might do that later just as an exercise for local students, and find out what number you are on the 192.168.100 network. IP addresses are handed out by a DHCP server, which we'll talk about a little bit later, and our DHCP server remembers what address it handed you last time, and provided nobody else has taken that address or we've run out of an address pool, it will actually hand you the same address out each time. So that is the network and host portion.
Okay, so you have IP addresses are also divided into class. They're very class conscious, are these IP addresses. We have a Class A network, and that's usually used for large networks implemented by many of your large companies. Class B, which is a medium-sized network. Class C, which is a smaller one. And Class D, which is used for multicasting. We'll talk about that a bit more. And Class E, which is used for testing or for experimental testing.
Just to summarise, Class A is 0 to 127, 16.7 million addresses per subnet. Class B is 128 to 191, 65,536 IP addresses per subnet, or 2 to the power of 16. Class C is 192 to 223, 256 IP addresses or 254 hosts per network, just to summarize the classes. Class D being multicast, which is 220 to 224 to 240, and we talk about that a little bit later, and Class E for experimental, which is 240 and up, which is weird stuff that they're messing with. That is for IPv4.
Okay. We did mention the subnet mask a little while ago, and that's we use that to indicate the network portion of an IP address. It's located, a dot decimal number, and all of the hosts within a local area network, as Kerry mentioned before, use the same subnet mask. So, for example, let me see.
Well, if you had an IP address.
Class, yeah, I was just going to go into that.
I was going to say,
go on,
I was going to say class, say for our 192.168.100 network. As I said, 192 to 223 is a Class C network. The subnet mask for that network is 255.255.255.0. So Class A is 255.0.0.0. Class B is 255.255.0.0, and Class C is 255.255.255.0, and Class D is not 255.255.255.255, but it does work for A, B, and C. So the A, B, or C tells you one, two, or three lots of 255 before the zero. And if you're a Braille reader, you can remember it by thinking of A, B, and C as numbers 1, 2, and 3.
Okay, so you actually, when you're subnetting, you're actually logically dividing up your network. So, very important skill to be able to do. You can also manually configure, if you're working as a network administrator, you can manually configure your network. You might want to, you need as a network administrator to really be very familiar with IP addressing and subnetting.
I'm going to make a statement here that will make sense to you guys when you work in the networking field in about 2.5 years to 3 years' time or a year's time. The subnet mask you configure on a workstation is only relevant to the workstation that it is configured on. So the device you configure a subnet mask is only relevant to the device that it is configured on. So make sure the subnet masks are correct on your routers and your workstations, or bad things TM will happen.
We will be going lots and lots more into IP addressing as we go along. In the old IT one, we did it sort of pretty very early in the piece, didn't we, Kerry?
We did.
So you've had a little bit of a break. You've got all the way to Module 8 before we actually start about it. Okay, so another aspect of addressing, or well, not so much addressing, but working on networks, is learning about DHCP. Anyone want to tell me what that stands for?
Anyone tell me what the D stands for?
No? Okay. It's dynamic. Anyone want to say what the H stands for?
Rhymes with toast. Yes, host. Host. Dynamic host.
All right. C, what does that stand for? Yeah, configuration, that's right.
Interestingly enough...
Well done.
We have two different expansions for this acronym. The notes actually say Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, which is actually what most people say, and that's what we're going to accept for the test, but the actual expansion for the acronym is actually Dynamic Host Control Protocol. And that's what the RFCs state, so just be aware of that.
Interesting, that, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so if you hear it referred to as either is correct.
That's right.
But for your exams, you better remember configuration. Okay, and what that is a software utility, and it dynamically assigns IP addresses to your network devices. Can anyone, another way we can actually assign IP addresses starts with an S. Can we? Anyone else tell me what that word might be? Thank you. Yes, you can statically, and we'll talk more about dynamic and static IP addresses as we go along too. So basically what dynamic does is it eliminates the need for actually manually assigning an IP address, whereas that is what you do with a static IP address. Okay, so you can set up your server or to configure your IP addresses automatically.
And what we do, generally home routers and stuff have a DHCP server in them. So if you wish to use the DHCP server, you can get your addresses handed out dynamically. However, one of the things to be aware of is that a home router doesn't remember which IP addresses got handed out to who through power cycles. So if you have any port forwards in effect, you'd better statically assign your addresses, otherwise the port forwards will break if your IP address changes. The other thing to keep in mind is that you can actually set up, it's generally not a good idea to set servers or networking equipment to be dynamically assigned IP addresses, because if the DHCP server or servers is down, you may find critical pieces of your network unable to get themselves IP addresses.
And as we go along, you'll be learning about how to do it statically, so you'll be able to set up your own network that way if you so wish. Okay, so the DHCP server can assign a number of bits of information to hosts that are on the network. It can assign the IP address, your subnet mask, also the default gateway, and things like your DNS server address. So how it works is the server receives a request from a host, so the server then selects an IP address information from that host, and once it's got that information, it then offers these values to the host on the network. So then if your host actually accepts the offer, the server, it actually leases out the IP address. So it dynamically gives that host an address, and it does that for a specific period of time. And it's a good way for simplifying the administration of a network. And the server would then keep track of all those IP addresses and automatically configure TCP/IP. And also doing it that way, it avoids the possibility of assigning duplicate IP addresses to hosts on the network.
And there were actually historically packet protocols with deterministic address mechanisms, where you'd guess at an address and see if anybody else was using it, and if they weren't, you would then use it, and that were protocols such as AppleTalk, which worked until you got a lot of machines on the network, with a lot of them being turned off a lot of the time, and then sometimes turned on, you would actually find that machines would step on each other with address allocation. Just to clarify very briefly, in case you're reading documentation, the first request sent out from a host is called a discover. The next one is called an offer. You then have a request, and then you have an acknowledgement, and they're the phases of the DHCP. If you send out a discover, if you already have an IP address, you can bypass the discover phase, and you can send out a request. But then if the server NACs you, or DHNACs you, because of the DHCP negative acknowledgement, you then have to send out a discover request, and then the server is free to offer you a different IP address. You are not allowed to continue using an IP address that a server DHNACs you on, because that address is apparently not for your use, according to the server. So a bit more information than in the notes, but might sort of explain things, especially once you start getting into Linux and the DHCP servers there. If you do ITE2, you'll actually see the exchanges go past, and you'll go, oh yeah, he mentioned those discovers and NACs and things.
Okay, now, if, for example, your computer can't communicate with the DHCP server to get its IP address, your operating system will assign a private IP address, or Windows will. And if you get a private address and it's assigned in the range of 169.254.0.0 to the range of the same with 169.254.255.255, and you'll be able to communicate with computers that are in that same range. One of the examples of when you might find a private address useful is if you're in a classroom situation and you want to prevent access outside of your own network. Yes, Grace?
Your button. We can't hear you at the moment, Grace. I'm not sure whether your button's not working or...
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yep.
We gotcha.
I'm getting a new headset, you guys. It's going to be great. we were reading about private IP addresses reserved for private use, and I'm not remembering the 169 addresses being in that group. So I'm just curious about that.
Ah, well, you see, Microsoft decided that they couldn't abide by anybody else's standard, so they made their own. As I said, with the private IP addresses I talked about, 10.0.0.0/24, 172.16-172.31/16, 192.168.x.x/24, Microsoft had to have their own range, which is called the APIPA range, A-P-I-P-A, Automatic Private IP Address Allocation, and that's 169.254. And it's what gets assigned to your network card. If no DHCP server is available, you are set to automatically grab your IP address and you haven't disabled auto-configuration, which you can in the advanced settings of your network card.
Which was the next thing I was going to say, actually. So that was good. Does that make that clearer, Grace?
Oh, completely. I just hadn't seen that in my notes when I was reading them today.
Okay, no worries. Now, throughout the day, we've been talking a little bit about protocols. Now, when we're referring to protocols, we're talking about a set of rules. So we all live by rules, and in computer lingo, we're talking protocols. If we're talking about the internet, for example, it has its own set of protocols, and they're, you know, just rules that govern how the communication works between the computers on that particular network. One of the things, well, there's a number of protocols that we have to have, and the main functions of those protocols would be to help us to identify errors, compress our data, making decisions about how data's sent and that type of thing, also addressing rules, and deciding how to send or receive that data. So, as I said, we live by all sets of rules, and in this type of lingo, we're talking about protocols. So one of those protocols that we have, for example, is ICMP. Anyone want to tell me what ICMP stands for?
Something message protocol?
Oh, you're close, yeah. It's actually Internet Control Message Protocol. And it's used by the devices, where you've got the devices on a network, they use it to control and send error messages to computers and servers on the network. Okay, so it can tell you when there's, or it'll let you know when there's a network error. It'll also tell you if there's network congestion, and you can use it for troubleshooting. Something called ping is commonly used to test connections between computers. Anyone want to tell me what ping stands for?
Anyone? Ping.
Ping. Ping.
Sorry, go.
I'm sorry, what ping does?
No, yeah. What's it stand
for? No, what it stands for. The initials ping, P-I-N-G. What does it stand for?
Anybody know?
You'll need to know this one. It stands for...
Is it to test some IP address?
It is used for testing.
Is it a command? Is it a command?
Yeah, but what does P-I-N-G stand for? It's an acronym.
Yep. It actually stands for packet. We've got packet internet. And the next...
Well, the next one's, I think we're going to have to give it to you,
Groper. Ping, packet internet Groper.
That's not the packet internet, Trevor.
And it's used to test connections between, well, it's commonly used to connect test connections between computers.
And it was actually a term that was used in World War II for the sonar that was used on submarines for detecting ships and stuff. It don't mean a thing if you don't get that ping, was the little phrase they used to say.
And you've all heard those movies where they're using the sonar on the submarine and going, ping, ping.
Always makes me laugh, because in the German movies, they're all sort of standing there going, ja, ich will get ein Gross Brot. And you're like, yeah, okay, what you actually said was, I want a loaf of bread from the corner store, but I'm sure that was really warlike.
Okay, so...
So, a question.
Yeah.
You talk about your pings here, checking your pings. Is that the same thing?
Yes, there is actually a ping built into the Ventrilo protocol. And that actually makes sure that the server is alive and reachable. And the ping round trip time is the time it takes for you to get a packet to and from the server. So if we say, oh, the ping's up at 500 milliseconds, it means that it's taking 500 milliseconds to get a packet to and from our Ventrilo server.
Yeah, so we're getting extreme sort of delays. You know, sometimes we've been talking, Jenny, and, you know, you'll hear us saying it's 1100 or something, you know. That's correct, Packet Internet Groper. So, yeah, it's in Ventrilo, it's just taking a long time.
Okay. And that can be caused by a number of things. One of the things that can be caused by is people hammering our web server and mirroring our content for some reason in lecture time, so which is why the web server gets shut down. So probably be aware that you're not going to be able to look up www.qcat.org during the lecture because I've shut the web server down.
Anyway, ping's really handy sort of utility to use. It's a command line utility, and it'll let you know whether a specific IP address is accessible. So you can ping the IP address to test your connectivity. It does that by it sends an ICMP echo request to a destination computer or to another network device, and then that device sends a message back, which is called an ICMP echo reply, to confirm the connectivity. So it's very, very useful.
And under Linux, there is actually an option if you're logged into the console or if you're logged in via a terminal called ping-a, and it's an audible ping, and it'll beep whenever a packet comes back, which is kind of useful if you're crawling around on the floor, plugging and unplugging cables to see if you can find an intermittent cable fault you can hear when the beeps stop.
That is really cool. It would be really annoying in any other circumstance.
Absolutely.
Now, we talked a little while ago about switches, okay? A switch is a physical device on a network. What would be some other common devices that you would use on a network? Physical devices.
Hubs.
Scanner.
Hubs, yep. Hubs. Really,
no,
Jenny.
A scanner is not a network device. Yes.
Routers, yep. Yep. Wireless access points would be another
one.
How
about over troubled waters? There's another one of those. Have we said that one yet? Yeah, bridge.
That bridge will lay it down. Do-do-do-do-do. Okay. So you need those physical components on your network. Obviously, the network ain't going to work if you ain't got them. There's some good English for you. And those components actually move the data across the devices. We talked about the different types of media, and we talked about, and we're going to go a little bit more into that, is twisted pair cabling, fibre optic cabling, and also wireless, which uses radio waves. Okay, I'm just going back. Okay, so anyone want to have a go at explaining what a hub is?
Okay, so a hub is a device that sends out any signal sent to it to every other computer on it. It has no way of forwarding it to the right place, so it just sends them all.
So that means, is it kind of like a relay then?
It's actually technically a multi-port repeater. So it gets a signal in one port and it sends the signal out to every other port. And if it sees a collision, it actually sends a jamming signal out all of the other ports so that people realise that there's a collision. But yes, a repeater is a device that's used to extend cable segment length, and it boosts a signal and retimes it. But a hub is actually a multi-port repeater. It repeats out to multiple ports. They're fairly rare in 2009 on regular local area networks. You don't see a lot of hubs. Most things you buy from a shop now are switches.
And we talked about bridges too, so I'll just talk a little bit more about those. So, alright, so they're all ways of moving data within the network. When we talk about data, we can have a number of the files. They're actually broken up to small components or pieces of data, and we refer to them, as Kerry mentioned before, as packets. So they get added up and transmitted over the network. when it's doing that, it looks for errors and makes sure that the packet is okay to go. And it also adds the address information to the beginning and also to the end of the packet. And that happens actually before it's transmitted. When we sort the packet, when we've actually put the address onto the packet, we then refer to it as a frame. Okay. So the other thing is with the local area network, they're divided into sections and we refer to those sections as segments. So you're segmenting it up, you're dividing it into little compartments. The boundaries of your segments can also be defined using a bridge, and a bridge is simply a device that filters the network traffic between your local area network segments, and it then keeps a record of all the devices on each segment of the network to which your bridge is connected. What happens next is when the bridge receives a frame, it looks at the destination address and it then makes the decision to decide whether the frame is to be sent to a different segment. And if it decides that that's the case, it sends it on, but it can also make the decision to drop that that frame.
It also is worth mentioning that a switch is technically a multi-port bridge.
So our switches have got a number of different ports. They can be two, they can be four. They can be a lot more than that as well. It's got several ports, depending on how many network segments you want to have linked to it. So it's a bit sophisticated than a bridge. The switch maintains a table which has got your MAC address for your computers that are connected to each port. So when you have a frame arriving at the port, the switch then compares the address information that's in the frame and it compares it to the MAC address table. And then it decides which port it's going to use to forward a particular frame. Now with a router, when you, for example, whereas you've got a switch connecting segments of a network, the routers connect the entire network to each other. So the switch uses MAC addresses to forward a frame within a single network, whereas the router uses the IP addresses to forward frames to other networks. So it can be as simple as a computer with a network software installed, or it can be a device that's built by your manufacturers, which most of us use these days. And I think that's the major difference between them. A wireless access, access point provides network access, as it sounds, via wireless for things like your other computers on the network or laptops or PDAs, that sort of thing. So you can sit in your lounge room theoretically and have your access point in another room. So very handy devices. You can also get multi-purpose devices.
You can certainly get multi-purpose devices, and those multi-purpose devices are convenient because they integrate multiple functions into one handy-dandy device. For example, you can have a home wireless ADSL router which contains a switch, a wireless access point, an ADSL modem, and a router, all jammed into the one little itty-bitty box that sits on your sideboard if you're at our place, or wherever else you decide to put it. Yeah, with an aerial that sticks out the top of it, and a phone line connection in, and the ability to connect up to four wired stations. Although at our place you've actually got an ADSL modem which does have four ports on it, but we're only using one of them, and it's actually wired into a Linux box that has two Ethernet ports, and it runs a firewall software. But then again, I'm a bit of a control freak, so yeah. But most people just use their home router as their single and only firewall defence.
Thank you. I think I've got my tongue back in the right way now. Put my fourth teeth in.
Now we get you a red lorry, yellow lorry. No, let's move on.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing how you get a bit tongue-tied after 1.5 hours
of talking. Sixth sheep's sick.
Yeah, something like that. Okay. Now, we talked earlier about different types of cabling, but we've only just touched on it, and I will cover it because you do get it in your exams. So, yeah, we will go through it. One of the types of cabling, twisted pair, which is a type of copper cabling, and it's used in most Ethernet networks, also used in telephone communications. As it sounds, you've got a pair of wires that forms a circuit and that transmits the data. And twisted pair is good because it helps provide protection against crosstalk. And when you've got crosstalk, you've got that sort of noise, you've all experienced it probably, generated by adjacent pairs of wires in the cable. The pairs of copper wires are encased in colour-coded plastic insulation and they actually get twisted together. And you've got like an outer protection or an outer jacket that protects the pairs of your twisted cables.
Can anybody tell me why is it twisted? What does the twisting actually do for the cable? Does anybody know? Apart from making it look cool and go round and round.
Does it make it stronger?
No. I heard an inhalation from Glaze. It minimises crosstalk, it doesn't prevent it. What actually happens is when the pairs are twisted and the... If you're an electrician, you'll know about the right-hand rule. But as the electricity travels along the pairs, it goes round and round and round, and it actually sets up a magnetic field around the cable that shields it from interference because of this the current travelling in a circular direction. And that magnetic field is what actually makes the forms around the pair that actually protects it from and minimises crosstalk.
Explanation. You've got two types of twisted pair. I was just thinking... And electricity goes round and round, whoa, 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 through the twisted pair.
I wasn't.
Okay. Okay, so two types of twisted pair cables. You've got unshielded twisted pair, or UTP. You've probably all heard that terminology. And that has two or four pairs of wires, and... it relies on cancellation effect produced by the twisted wire pairs, and it limits the degradation you get of the signal by electromagnetic and magnetic interference, also from radio frequency interference. And it's commonly, most commonly used cabling in networks. Now, something you do need to know, UTP cables have a range of 328 feet, for our friends in the US and Canada, and 100 metres for everybody else, I think. shielded twisted pair is the other one, or STP, and you've got, the wires are wrapped in a foil, a metallic foil, and it shields, as it sounds, the wires from noise. So you've got your four pairs of wires, got a metallic braid or foil wrapped in them, or wrapped around them, I should say. It reduces electrical noise from in the cable and also reduces EMI and RFI from outside the cable. STP prevents interference better than UTP, but it's more expensive as most of these things go. Okay, I might get you to hurry through the category ratings there, Kerry, while I just scroll down. Different, you know, okay. Category 5, yeah, Category 6,
Category 3 is, the category ratings, 3, 4, well, that's actually category 1 through 5. The higher the category rating, the more twists per metre. But category 3 is good for 10 megabits per second Ethernet, and it only has to have two pairs. Category 4, I'm not actually sure of, but category 5 is good for 100 megabits per second full duplex. Category 5E is good for gigabit, and Category 6 is actually what is recommended for gigabit. And the difference with Category 5E and Category 6 is that there is actually a separator piece of plastic that keeps all four pairs, even, not pores, we're not talking about dogs, all four pairs separated, and the little twisty thing that goes down the middle actually stops those pairs from coming in contact with each other, so that also minimises crosstalk. Which means that Category 6 is slightly less flexible than Category 5 because of the plastic thing that goes down the middle of the cable. But it's recommended for new installations, especially those that want to use gigabit or 10 gigabit Ethernet technologies.
Okay, that's good, thanks. Okay, other types of cabling, as we touched on before, is fibre optics, and that's where you've got glass or plastic conductor, and it transmits information using light. So obviously that's where it gets its optic and fibre name from, fibre optic. And it, you've got one or more optical fibres, and they're enclosed in that jacket like the others. And because it's glass, fibre optic cable doesn't get affected by EMI or by RFI interference. All of the signals that go through it are converted to light pulses, so they enter the cable and then they get converted back into electrical signals when they leave it. And that means that fibre optics is able to deliver very nice clear signals, and also they've got a potential for greater bandwidth, and obviously they can travel further. With fibre optics, you can actually have distances of a number of kilometres before the need to regenerate the signal. The downside is it's more expensive to use than copper, it's a bit harder to work with too. Some of your common connectors for your fibre optic networks are SC, ST and LC connectors, and they work on half duplex, those when you're using those types of connections, so they only working in one direction.
Just a point that on campuses and things, optical fibre is often run between buildings as it is not susceptible to lightning strikes.
So if it's running at like half duplex, how is it faster than untwisted pair?
Because you can send a lot more. Yeah, that's okay. You can run a lot more light pulses along one cable a lot more quickly than you can run, say, shifting electrical signals. So you're looking at gigabit and 10 gigabit speeds. So you might only be able to send 10 gigabits in one direction at a time, but the fact is you usually have two fibres wrapped in a sheath, which is then insulated with Kevlar for strengthening the cable. But the two fibres that are wrapped in the sheath, one is a send and the other is a receive.
Okay. And you can also get two types of glass fibre optic cables. This is the multi-mode. With multi-mode, it's got a thicker core than what does single mode cable. So it's a bit easier to make, and it can use simpler light sources like LEDs, and it works well over distances of a few kilometres or less. Single mode fibre optics has got a very thin core, so that makes it harder to work with, harder to make, and it uses lasers as a light source. And it can actually transmit signals many kilometres. Okay, so it's that's the difference. What I'm going to do is actually leave the module there, because we're only about halfway, would you believe, through this module. So you may want to have a pre-read of the second half, where we'll be starting about talking about topologies and architectures of networks. I don't want to hurry through all this because it's very important. And I would suggest that you reread what we've done today, because it's a quite new principles that are coming up today. Principles is the wrong word. Topic that's coming up today. You know, we're talking about IP addressing. So if you don't know about it, you haven't done CCNA, I would go back over that section or this half of the module, try and move on before we move on next week. As Kerry mentioned, and I'll forewarn you, we're going to do that quiz on printers and scanners again next week, just to make sure you've know about them, so you might want to study up on that. And next week, because of Good Friday here on Friday, where we won't be in at work, the lectures will take place, IT1 will take place on Thursday morning instead. So I'll come in on Thursday morning to do that lecture.
Which means you won't be doing your Thursday chat next week, Grace, but you will get a chance to do it after the holidays. So we apologise for that, but it is important. We don't really want to lose a lecture for ITE if we can help it.
Oh, that's totally fine. I'll do it if people are interested.
I'm sure they will be.
Yep.
Yeah. And so we'll do that next Thursday. And just a little bit of housekeeping here. The following 2 weeks, Kerry and I will both be not giving lectures. That is student free time here due to school holidays. So you'll have I'll mention it again next week anyway. But next Thursday you will have a lecture as usual. And then for 2 weeks there will be no lectures.
However, okay. We will be in at work. Well, Geraldine will be off. Geraldine's
I'm off on leave.
Yep, but I will be in here. Just spare a thought for me alone in the association. I'll be in here. Yeah, thank you. But we will be available, and I will be on Skype if anybody has any questions and stuff, and we'll certainly look into that, and so that you can ask your questions and email your questions in and Skype and all those sorts of things, and you can still submit worksheets and labs, which will get marked when we get around to it. So keep working, don't stop, or at least if you are going to stop, stop constructively, because this is one of the good options for you to catch up if you're a little bit behind.
Now, before we sign off today, does anyone have any questions that you would like to ask? Questions, comments, songs, whatever.
And we are going to record audio answers for the Discovery exams, in case anybody was wondering about that. We have the snowball here.
Oh, I had a question about Discovery.
Ah, well, you can ask that, I suppose.
Yeah, why not?
I just took Chapter 5's quiz, and it was fine. But when are the diagram descriptions going to be up for the next few chapters?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and the answer is I have no idea. And I will rouse on our fearless leader, who's we're supposed to be getting people to help with the diagram descriptions. And unfortunately, there aren't that many people doing diagram descriptions because it's long, boring, and tedious. So we have to make sure we find some volunteers and tie them down and beat them with a big stick, and get them to describe all the pictures. It is a worthwhile thing to be doing, but it is just difficult to get people who are focused enough to sit down and explain what's in the diagrams and stuff for people, so we are going to try and work on that. But that is a very good question. When are they going to be up? So we'll chase that up. We do have this Iranian guy, but he had a cold, so he didn't come in. He might be in next week, but I'm just not sure. I know all the diagram descriptions are really tedious, but there is an incredible amount of work in those diagram descriptions. Sitting down and explaining all those pictures. Pictures really do have 1,000 words in them. No, the lecture is at 9 a.m. Perth time, which is 6:30 Indian time, because you're 2.5 hours behind us now.
Yeah, you got the Indian time right, Suprita, but the Perth time, yeah, 9 a.m. Perth time.
It's almost 11 o'clock here, 11 o'clock, which would mean that it is almost 8:30 where you are.
And now, just at this point, we can probably stop recording, by the way, I guess. unless everybody, have you all finished your questions?
Any other questions?
Yep. Just before we stop recording, and then I was just going to make an observation, comment, whatever.